When Allen Iverson drove the 76ers to the NBA Finals in 2001, the team surrounding him was put together by Coach Larry Brown and Vice President and General Manager Billy King. Later at GM with the Brooklyn Nets, King gives his take on what the Sixers' summer roster makeover should look like.
I think you need as much shooting as possible around Joel and Maxey. And then when I say shooting, you need like the Kyle Korvers, the J.J. Redick type shooting, just to space the floor for Maxey and Joel. And then I would try to get as many 6'8 long athletic guys, because you're going to have to guard Tatum, Jaylen Brown, the Knicks.
King also reveals for the first time the other teams besides Denver where Allen Iverson could have been traded back in 2006. This and more with Billy King next on Fresh 24. Billy Matthew King, Vice President and General Manager of the 76ers when they went to the finals back in 2001. What a ride. Referee for a lot of disagreements between Larry Brown and Allen Iverson. Former GM of the Brooklyn Nets, Duke standout, former WIP talk show host, Managing Director at Turnkey ZRG. We got to talk about that. Also, a husband and a father. Billy King, welcome to Fresh 24.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Mark. I'm looking forward to it.
Listen, I got to get right into it because we recently spoke with Allen Iverson, and one of the things that we talked about was December 19th, 2006. As you know, the day he was traded to the Denver Nuggets, and I'll ask you what I asked him. Wasn't there a way to continue to make it work?
Well, you know, we had talked about that probably a couple weeks before the decision was made to move him, and we had agreed to make it work. He wanted to be here. I told him that the plan was to build some young talent around him. And then about a couple weeks later, maybe it was even a week later, he came back, got a call from Leon Rosen and said that, you know, Allen wants to be traded. And I said, we just discussed this. You know, are you sure? He goes, yeah, he's sure. I said, all right, I'm going to go talk to Allen. Because once this train gets moving, it's going to be hard to put it back in. So we talked. I went down in the court, and I said, you sure? He goes, yeah, I think it's time. I said, okay. I said, now we're going to do this. I said, but it's, once it gets going, it's going to be hard to pull back. And he said, it's time. And I felt it was time also. So, you know, he gave me a couple places that he'd like to see if we can do it. I said, if I can make it work, it helps us, we'll do it. And Denver was one of them. So I felt good that he was going to a place that he wanted to be. And I felt the organization was able to restart with Andre Miller and some picks and cap flexibility. So, but it was, you know, we tried, but I think it was probably best for both parties at that time for a clean break.
I think about Moses Malone, the late great. I think about Charles Barkley and those trades. And it never seems you actually get what I guess you would term full value for a superstar. Do you think it's a general rule that is the way it is in the NBA?
Yeah, you generally are not going to get full value, because either if you're trading a superstar in their prime, you know, maybe you can get another superstar in their prime. But generally, if you're trading one that's towards the past, now I wouldn't say Allen was past his prime, but he was on the other side of his prime, it's going to be hard for you to recoup, you know, actual value. And if you are, you're getting somebody else's superstar that you may not want what's coming. Generally, when you're doing it, you're trying to either clean your books up to give yourself flexibility, get as many assets as you can so you can start to rebuild. But it is hard to get true value. I remember when I first got in the league, Mitch Richmond was being traded, and Jeff Petrie said, Billy, I got to get an all-star. And I kept saying, you're not going to get one. And he waited. He ended up getting Chris Webber at that point. He was young and he was an all-star when he made that trade. But I think that helped Sacramento. I don't think it helped Washington as much, because I think Mitch was on the other side of that equation.
You had mentioned that Leon Rose, now, of course, the president of the Knicks, was representing Allen then. presented you with a couple of options. You said Denver was one. Are you at liberty to talk about the other? And did you have a deal in place there as well?
Yeah, the other ones were, you know, the Clippers was one, and then Minnesota was the other one. And, you know, I talked to all three as well as talked to a lot of other teams to see. And there, you'd be amazed some of the other offers we've got from teams during that process. But it just came down. One of my mentors, who I won't name his name, who was a current president GM, gave me a strategy. He said, you know, you got to get people bidding on each other. Got to make them think that, you know, the other one we can get is going to be tipping the balance of power. And that's what I did, you know, especially because Denver, LA, and Minnesota are all in the same conference. And so it got to the point where Denver made the offer that I thought was best for us. And I knew that Minnesota couldn't beat it because I knew what they needed. They were trying to get, they couldn't accomplish, and I knew the Clippers couldn't get it. With the Clippers, I was trying to get that point. They had a young Sean Livingston, and I was trying to, if I could get him in the deal, I thought it'd be a great move for us at that point, because you put a young Livingston, who was a 6'7", 6'8", point guard, with Andre Iguodala's buying skills, with Korver, with Iguodala, I mean, with Korver, with Willie Green, Thaddeus Young. I thought, you know, same doubt, we'd have a young, dynamic team, but couldn't get him in the deal.
I also told Alan another story. This dates back to the late 90s. I was at a practice, and he and Jerry Stackhouse started jawing at one another. Larry Brown blows the whistle. They go to the water cooler, and suddenly a fight breaks out, and they're throwing haymakers at one another. Do you remember that?
Was that at the Healthplex? Or
It was either there, or it was at Wells Fargo Center. I don't know if it was necessarily a shoot-around, but I do remember the two of them going at it. And of course, Jerry was later traded, which kind of, I think, started the formation of the 2001 team. He goes to Detroit, Aaron McKee, Theo Ratliff come to the Sixers. What went into deciding that it just wasn't going to work with Allen and Jerry together?
Well, one, we looked at it, and, you know, Allen was going to be the scorer, dynamic scorer, and Larry viewed Allen more as a two guard than a point guard, and that was really Jerry's position. And the fact that they both were drafted like right after each other, and Jerry was brought in, it was going to be his team. Then Allen came in, it was going to be his team. And it's hard to do that with two young guys that are trying to establish themselves in the league. And Allen was just rookie of the year. But more than anything, we wanted Theo Ratliff, the anchor of the defense. We thought he was a young up and coming center. And so the goal was to get him. And if we can use Jerry to get him, that was going to be the piece. And I'll never forget, Larry and I were talking, and we had been talking back and forth with Detroit. And I remember Theo and Aaron McKee both had a great game. And Larry calls me while we're watching the game. He goes, they're never going to make the deal. Yeah, I said, I know. I'm sitting there. I'm afraid. So I called the next day and said, look, we need an answer, because otherwise we're going to move Jerry. We got a deal. We're going to move him. And so they went and came back and said, okay, we'll do the deal. So we were able to put a little pressure and get it done.
To me, the whole part about putting deals together, talking to other GMs, is fascinating. I want to touch on that in a few moments. But first, going back to the 2001 team, Dikembe Mutombo, mostly a defensive player, could certainly get his. Aaron McKee, to an extent. But in a broad sense, this is Allen and a bunch of defensive guys. Was that the thing that you say to yourself, or did Larry say, hey, we got to just put a bunch of hard-nosed guys around Allen and let him do his thing?
Well, I mean, that's Larry Brown's team. I mean, Larry is a, you know, defense first, play hard, rebound the basketball, share the basketball. So when we started, like you said, we started with Aaron McKee and Theo. Theo was going to be the defensive anchor, but shot blocker back there we needed. Then we had to get Allen off the ball. And so we looked, and Eric Snow was that. That was the, you know, the reasoning behind drafting Larry Hughes, thinking a bigger guard that could play point with Allen. So that was the whole thought process, to get Allen to the two guard, get somebody that can guard, play the point, guard the bigger people, or help Allen. And so as we're piecing it, then George Lynch was somebody we liked, we signed. I don't think we had envisions that he was going to start, but he was a good piece, a good teammate. And so it was just building pieces that we thought that would play hard, and defense was first, foremost. Because, you know, I think back to our teams when I was coaching with Larry in Indiana, I mean, we had Reggie Miller, Rick Smith, but otherwise it was just a bunch of defensive guys, Dell Davis, Antonio Davis, Haywood Workman, Derek McKee. We traded Derek, I mean, Indiana, we traded Detlef Schrempf, sixth man of the year, for Derek McKee. Mm-hmm. And Detlef was a scorer, and Derek was a defensive guy. So that was, you know, my 4 years of working with Larry as a coach, that was our vision. You know, that's how I knew the NBA is, all right, we're going to play defense, be physical, be aggressive, and we'll figure out how to score. And I figured out score was how many shots we can get Allen, and we're going to score off the defense. We're going to get turnovers. We're going to offensive rebound. But we're going to grind it out every night.
So you mentioned Larry Hughes, and certainly a lot of second guessing and 2020 hindsight with him and not selecting Paul Pierce. Oftentimes people will say you should pick the best player and worry about it later, as opposed to a need, which you clearly were addressing with Larry Hughes. In retrospect, Paul Pierce turned out to be a Hall of Famer, yeah. But in retrospect, would you have changed your philosophy and said, all right, better player, more experienced, Larry Hughes just a freshman, we need to go with Paul Pierce?
Yeah, after that draft, myself personally, my staff, we did change. And we, because generally we would rank them 1 through 60, and we, how we would select, not how, you know, they're ranked, but how we would select them if we had that pick. Who would we take number one? Who would we take number two? Who would we take number 10? And then as guys come off the board, we just mark them off. And so as we get down to our pick, we take the next person that we had ranked in order. And so from that day on, and the rest of my drafts, we never deviated from the board. Because Paul Pierce was ranked higher on the board than Larry Hughes. So after that draft, we never deviated from the board. And it, my last draft with the Sixers, it came down. Thaddeus Young was ranked higher. Some people, you know, one person wanted me to take Al Thornton. But on the board, we had Thaddeus Young ranked higher. And we stuck to the board and took Thaddeus Young, who still playing.
Yeah, amazingly so. Yeah. And he's played for a number of different teams. I only wish him a deep playoff run. But let me just get to one more question about the 2001 team. Following year, you sort of run it back. But then you trade George Lynch, you trade Tyrone Hill, and you bring in Derek Coleman. What was the thinking there?
Well, the original thing was, you know, Tyrone Hill, you know, he was coming up on the last year of his deal. He wasn't happy towards the end of the playoffs with his role, wanted out. George wasn't happy with his deal. He wanted a new deal, wanted us to renegotiate that deal. So my thought process, and I didn't think that same team, because the rules changed after that year. Before, they had the illegal defense, you could isolate guys and defense couldn't come over to help. After that season, they changed the rules. Well, now you could overload, as you see people loading up on the box. And so it was going to take away from Allen's ability to just, where we isolated him on the horns play that we call, and I think everybody calls it now, the Iverson cut, where he cuts across the
right. You know, the one up the lane.
Yeah. But now you can't exactly do that anymore because the defense shifted. So we had to adjust how we were going to play the team. So my thought process was to try to create some cap space. So by moving Tyrone, we brought in, I think, Matt Harpering, who I liked. He was going to be a free agent, tractor trailer from Michigan. There was another player from Cleveland. So, but it was getting some players that I thought would give us.
Cedric Henderson.
There you go. And so it was, and they all were expiring. So it was going to give us the flexibility. We can use cap space. But I thought if Matt Harpering could blossom into a player, I thought he could be, we could re-sign him and add him to as another young player. The season started out, you remember, Aaron had surgery on his shoulder. He was out. Allen had surgery on his elbow. He was out. Then Eric Snow had surgery. He was hurt in his foot. So we started the season without basically our top three backcourt. And so as the preseason went, we weren't playing well, you know. And so Larry, you know, was unhappy and we weren't going to get those guys back. So George wanted a new contract. So it was like, all right, let's get Derek Coleman and give somebody that can score. Larry liked him. He'd coach him. And so that was sort of trying to just piece it together until we were able to get the other guys back to be able to, and, you know, we ended up making the playoffs, losing, I think, to Boston in a best of five series in game five up there. But that was the thought process originally, the half cap space. And then it was like, okay, we need to regroup and add some more pieces.
Let's fast forward to 2010. You became the Nets GM. You took a 24-win team, and a couple of years later, you won 49. But then you broke that up, and you went for the aging Boston title trio, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Jason Terry. I know you've answered this question a million times. A bushel of first-round picks went away, and you rolled the dice with them. As best as you can, how much of that was you, and how much of it was the then-owner, Mikhail Prokhorov?
Well, it started out, you know, I wanted Paul Pierce. because I thought he would give us some. If I could have put Paul Pierce with Joe Johnson and Darren Williams and Brooke Lopez, you know, and Paul would give us some toughness that we didn't have. I thought losing Game 7 to Chicago, depleted Chicago Bulls at home, we didn't have that toughness. I thought we had it. And so then it morphed into, after Paul Pierce, the ownership asked, what about Kevin Garnett? So then I started, you know, added Carton. So I think they would help us set the culture and give us that. So we added, you know, went after those two guys. And then the deal just kept getting, you know, put Jerry Wallace in it to them. Then it was like, all right, we need a pick for that. And we need a pick for this. And the goal was to have it for 2 years. Ownership was on board to spend tax money for 2 years. And then have the, at the end of that, we would have cap flexibility. We'd have enough room to sign a max player because those guys would come off. And at that time, things changed in Russia, the economy. And at the end of that season, Prokhorov said, I don't want to spend anymore. reduce payroll. So now we lose Paul Pierce for nothing. We lose Kirilenko. We lose a lot of pieces for absolutely nothing, I think. And so now we ended up making the playoffs the next year. Then they said, okay, we want to be under the tax the following year. And so the plan was to be spend for 2 years, be productive. So the swaps wouldn't have been as effective because we were going to still be good. Once we went the other direction, the swaps came into play. The one regret I have, or, you know, lesson I learned, I probably would not have included the swaps in that deal because giving up three firsts, it would have been okay. But if you had the swaps at those years, so you're not really out of picks, but in thinking that we were, because we had done it the year before in the Joe Johnson trade, but it didn't matter because we were so much better. They didn't do the swaps. So I stuck with the same strategy, but we changed mid-course. So that was the thought process. But I never put it all on ownership. And I think we all sit down and make a decision as a group. And it was an organizational decision, but me being the GM falls on me. But as an organization, that was the position we wanted to go after because we wanted to win.
And I appreciate your candor and, some introspection there. Let me ask you, how often do GMs just try to, gauge their own player's worth? In other words, just say, hey, what would you give me for player X? That kind of thing. Does that happen?
Not really. Because if it's a star player, you don't want, because I would say this, when I first came in the league, you did it more. Because there was a trust factor that when you talk to somebody, you did it more and they're like, nah, anyway, if I would do something, I probably would add this, but I'm not sure if I would even make that trade and it wouldn't get out. When I came back with Brooklyn, there wasn't that same level of trust. So when you mention something, it got out right away. So you had to be very careful. And if you wanted to find out if somebody would move their superstar, you would go through the list like, you know, here's some guys on the team I like. And they would say, well, I would move everybody. I wouldn't move these guys. And if they didn't mention a guy, so like when we got Darren Williams, they would move. They didn't mention that they wouldn't move Darren Williams. So, okay, maybe he's available. But it's very hard to gauge. Because once you start gauging your guys' value, then you know that it's going to get out. If people ask about it, and you would just say like, you know, God, if I'm going to move that guy, it's got to be, I'm not moving him, but if you're going to move that guy, you got to be talking. I'll be looking at multiple picks just to start with.
Billy, how do you weigh the fact that a really good player is available, but he's a giant pain in the rear? You know what I'm saying? You're not sure if he's going to fit in. You think maybe he'll fit in. Your culture's strong enough. How do you weigh all that and eventually come to a decision whether or not to acquire them?
Well, I think you look at it and say, how long is this deal? You know, because if it's a long deal, then you say, okay, can we tolerate him for 4 years or however long the deal? If it's 2 years, okay, it's a short deal. After one, it's going to be an expiring contract. But then also you got to look at your roster and say, okay, do I have enough good guys on the roster that can be a positive influence? Because I think you can always have one, possibly one and a half bad apples. But if you get too many, they can overrun the locker room. So I think if you have enough quality people in your locker room, you can have a good impact. And then you got to also judge your coach. Can your coach, is he tough enough and strong enough to manage and handle that type of player?
Billy, I would like to get into the current edition of the Sixers, put you in the GM seat and tell me what you would do with the most cap room in the NBA this coming summer. But first, we have reached what we call halftime. And the first part of our halftime is the Garage Beer six-pack of questions. It is brought to you by Garage Beer, beer-flavored beer. Find some near you at drinkgaragebeer.com. I'll give you a choice between two things, and I want you to just blurt out the answer, all right? Don't think about it. Just blurt it out, all right? You ready?
Yep.
Here we go. Cheesesteak or soft pretzel?
Cheesesteak.
Center City or South Jersey?
Center City.
Gritty or Philly Fanatic?
Philly Fanatic.
Meek Mill or Hall & Oates?
Meek Mill.
Dr. J or Allen Iverson throwback?
Allen Iverson throwback.
Liberty Bell or Rocky Steps?
Liberty Bell.
Some people don't even think, they say when you say Rocky Steps, like, come on, it's the art museum.
Yeah.
Rocky Steps.
Oh, I say Liberty Nowhere Bell, but being a political science major, I got to go with the Liberty Bell.
Okay. A political science major. Yeah. Huh? Any thoughts about running for? Never mind.
No, that was always always a goal of mine, to be governor.
Is that right?
Yeah,
that's right. You know what? Yeah. I do remember that now, but yeah. We'll save that for later. Six pack of questions brought to you by Garage Beer, beer flavored beer. Find some near you at drinkgaragebeer.com. All right, Billy, you're back in the NBA. You're the general manager of the 76ers. You're going to have a ton of cap room. What are you doing?
Well, you're in the win now mode. I mean, you've got to win. So you got to look at the, you know, how many players that you can acquire with the space to have a positive impact with Joel. And it's tricky because Joel is going to need a lot of touches. He's going to get the majority of the touches. You want Maxi to still have the flexibility to be able to create and do his thing. So in bringing in another guy, it's got to be somebody that understands they may not get as many touches. So to me, it's got to be somebody that can hit a knockdown open three, or create them for themselves off the dribble. But really, I think you need as much shooting as possible around Joel and Maxi. I mean, I think you need, and then when I say shooting, you need like the Kyle Korver's, the JJ Redick type shooting, just to space the floor for Maxi and Joel. And then I would try to get as many 6'8 long athletic guys I can, because you're going to have to guard Tatum, you know, Jaylen Brown, the Knicks. You need as many of those guys so you're switching and defensively. So if you can find 4, 5, 6, 8 long athletic players, and then as much shooting, if they can be 3-and-D guys, it's even better. But length and shooting, to me, is a must to be as athletic as possible, because Joel is, for his size, he's athletic, but he's not as mobile because he's big. And so I think if you can complement him with length and athleticism, that you can get out and run. So when he's not in the game, or if he does get hurt, now you put them with Maxi, those guys are running and you have an up-tempo game and pace. But I think length and shooting is a must.
Are there some today George Lynch, Tyrone Hill, Eric Snow type guys around they could add for some toughness and rebounding?
Yeah, but the problem with today's game, it'd be harder for the Eric Snows and George Lynch, because, you know, George liked to think he could be a three-point shooter. He knocked down one every now and then, but I think it'd be even harder for Eric because he was not a three-point shooter. I think today's game, it's really hard. Now, unless you're, you know, Shea Alexander-Gilgeous, who can get in there and get your mid-range game. So you've got to be able to space the floor, because otherwise they wouldn't guard those guys and make it even tougher. You know, Paul George is available, but do you look at him, his age, whatever? I think I like the fact that he's a guy that can create it, but he's a guy that's, you know, he's been used to getting a lot of shots. And so if he's not going to get as many shots, is he going to be comfortable in that role? I don't know.
And that was going to be my question to you. Would he be comfortable in that role? Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, and I don't know if he will, just because.
Even at what? He's 34.
Because
chance to win a ring, perhaps?
Yeah, because even
in. Sell him on that?
Well, I mean, you had James Harden in that role, and everybody said he needs to be more aggressive, and he was more passive than he'd always been. He might be, but it's hard. And the thing about it, he's a West Coast guy. He wants to be on the West Coast. So if what would concern me, would he just be coming for the money? Because they give you 4 years. Okay, the Clippers aren't going to give me four. I'll go there because I can get 4 years. I'm in Philly. I really not. I want to be in California. Is he going to be That's what I worry. You want somebody that's coming for it. They should be wanting to come and win a championship, and money becomes secondary at this point in their career.
Care to throw out a name as to who you think would be the perfect third guy, whether by trade or free agency?
No, because it's hard. I think, you know, you have to get in and really look at it. And, you know, I mean, the guys, the usual suspects everybody talks about, Zach LaVine, you know, Jimmy Butler. Jimmy's missed a lot of games over the years. I mean, so is, you know, how many guys, and same thing with Paul George, how many guys are you going to want that you're going to miss? You know, I think you need a lot of guys that play more than 65. You know, you need guys getting the high 70s, maxi range of playing. You don't want guys that are playing 65 games, 60 games, because that's going to hurt you. And I think you can't put yourself so you're so far back that your seeding is hurts you. I think this year they had to play perfect to get to the eighth seed. They got always seventh, right? Yeah, seventh seed. But you don't want to have to do that. You want to be up there at 4 or 5 where you have a chance to get home court advantage. So you can't have guys where you're missing a lot of games because it hurts you come playoff time.
You know, today there's a lot of fashioning life around your star players. I don't want to use the word catering, but certainly accommodating. Leave it to Pat Riley to break that by saying, hey, Jimmy Butler, yeah, he'll get a contract if he shows he's available. Who else can do that in the NBA besides him?
Well, I mean, I think he and the Miami Heat organization is one of the most underrated organizations in the NBA. Pat has built that, you know, he built it with Alonzo Mourning and Jamal Mashburn. Mourning leaves, he rebuilds it with Dwayne Wade, and then he gets Shaq. And no, it gets Dwayne Wade, LeBron, and they actually had Shaq before those guys, I think. Am I correct? Yeah. And then he rebuilds it he just keeps rebuilding it every year. Mm-hmm. Now he's rebuilt it with Bam and those guys and Jimmy Butler. Because Mickey Arison has given him the ability to run it like he's run it for all these years. And with the backing of Mickey, so they all know this is the Heat culture. This is how we're going to do it. You've got to make your body weight, body fat. You've got to be in shape. You got to do certain things. If you don't, you won't play. And they don't deviate. No matter if you're LeBron, if you're Jimmy Butler, if you're this is how we do it in Miami. If you don't like it, you can go. We'll bring someone else in.
Why don't more teams do it that way?
I don't know if a lot of owners would support their president and GM the way Mickey has supported them, because they're willing to sacrifice maybe the wins and losses for the long haul. And you got to be tough because, you know, when they let Dwayne Wade go, they took a lot of heat. I mean, he was the face of the franchise, and they decided not to re-sign him. They took the heat, but they were okay taking that heat. And not a lot of people are willing to take that heat to do that.
Billy, you personally, you were born in Sterling, Virginia, went to high school about an hour west of Washington, D.C. What was it like for you growing up there?
I'll give you an example. I grew up, you know, when I was young, we lived in Bailey's Crossroads, which is really about not far from Washington, D.C. I want to say probably 20 minutes near Arlington, Virginia, right there. I grew up till I was 12 years old there. And, you know, we were in a low-income apartment complex. My cousins lived there, aunts and uncles, our church was right next door. So that was our world. And my dad died when I was 4.5 years old. My mom ended up having a boyfriend who moved in with us. And when I was 12, my older siblings, brother and sister, two of them, they were out of the house. They were 10, 11 years older, actually 12 and 11 years older. My other sister is 4 years older than me. I was in sixth, so she was in 10th grade. We moved from a predominantly, I want to say 98% black community and school to a community in Sterling, Virginia, which was probably 90% white, and the school was probably 95% white, which is more middle class. So it was eye-opening for me just to see things I had never seen before and be around people. But I think it was the best for me because it allowed me to learn about a lot of different lives. Some of my best friends, I grew up in Sterling to this day. But I did things and learned things. But I still would go back to where I grew up and play basketball, play AAU down there. But I was raised by my mom, my godmother, my aunts and uncles. I was raised by a lot of women around me. And so they taught me compassion, and, you know, believe in God, but mainly, you know, trust your neighbor and always be willing to help and give a hand. And that's been always my motto. People say I'm too nice, but I look at it like, you know, I'm going to do it the way I believe is right. And if people make a decision that they don't want me around, that's fine, but I'm doing what I think is right. And it's worked out for the best, because when Ed Snyder fired me with the Sixers, I understood, and he and I had lunch the next week. And then we were best friends until his passing. And with Brooklyn, I'm still friends with Perkoff and Dimitri, who ran the team. Because I look at it as like, it was a privilege that they gave me opportunity to run their organization for them. At the end of the day, they have to make a decision they think is best for them. Do I agree with the decision? No, but that's their decision. And so to me, I pick myself up and go into the next challenge.
It's an awesome outlook. I appreciate you sharing that. All right, here we go. Of course, basketball helped you a lot. You went to Duke, Mike Krzyzewski, blah, 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 blah. And of course, I say all that because I'm a Temple Owl guy. And in 1988, I watched you hold Mark Macon to 6 for 29 and eliminate the top-ranked Owls during the Elite Eight. I would imagine you two have met since then.
Oh, yeah.
And how does it work its way into a conversation even, or does it?
You know, it's funny. I was at game four of the Sixers, the series against the Knicks, and I was in the courtside lounge, and Tim Perry and Mark happened to be there, and we said hi, and Tim Perry walked back and goes, "I'm still mad at you," and he just kept walking. And he says that every time he sees me. Tim always says, every time he sees me, "I'm still mad at you." And Mark and I have talked, and one time I was walking in the Temple, I think I was a Sixers GM at the time still, and Mark happened to be walking with his son, and Mark said to his son, he goes, introduce him, this little boy to me. He goes, "See him? I used to kill him back in the day in college." And I just let it go, and you know, didn't want to hurt the little kid's feeling. But yeah, it's ironic that I've lived here now. Jeez, I moved here in 97. So, you know, I've lived here over 25 years of my life here in Philadelphia, a place where people will come up to me and say, "I ruined their senior year, ruined their spring break." And I just say, "You got to let it go. It's been a long time. You got to let it go." But it's, John Chaney's somebody I admired. I revered him. And when I came here, went to practice, I just loved talking to him and spending time with him, because I think what he did for the game of basketball for Temple, it's remarkable. I put him, there's people I look at in basketball, John Chaney, John Thompson, Coach K, Dean Smith, Bobby Knight. These were the people I grew up with when I was going to go to college. These were the icons. And they all did it with the way of discipline, and education came first, but discipline, and you're going to play a team game. And they were not afraid to speak out if they thought something was wrong, and they defended their players to the nth degree. Coach Chaney is, I mean, if you ask Coach K to talk about Coach Chaney, he will go overboard, because if he had been coaching in this modern social media environment, he would have been bigger than some of the great names in college basketball, because of what he stood for, and his ability to explain what he stood for was incredible.
Mm. Yeah, I got religion on Coach Chaney. May he rest in peace. You got time for three more questions,
yeah.
And I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Managing director at Turnkey ZRG. Sounds like a great gig. Perfect for you. Describe it, if you will.
Well, it's executive search firm. And Turnkey has been around since 1996. Len Perna started it. It was the oldest search firm for sports and media entertainment. And so we place candidates, whether it's in ticketing, marketing, CEOs, college basketball coaches, ADs, presidents, general managers. So it's really, and I tell people, I'm not a search consultant, I'm a problem solver. And so I talk to people, let me know your problem, let's figure out how to solve it. So, and that's really, and we're owned by ZRG, which is the seventh largest search firm in the world. And we have offices all over the world, and Brazil and Sydney, place like that. And it's full service, you know, you name it, we do search for it. And so I've been with Turnkey now for a little over 3 months. I've been in search for more than 2 years. And it's a great job because I get to help people. Like I said, you know, I've been involved with some college basketball searches. Now I'm involved with the search for a president of basketball operations right now, helping the Pistons out. And it's just, it's great just to listen and talking and use your expertise that I've learned to try to help. My goal is to try to make sure that people that the underrepresented are being represented in the process. They get a fair shake, a fair chance to present themselves for the job.
Interesting. Your son, Reggie, quite a baseball pitcher. I know your daughter plays field hockey, I believe at Syracuse. Is there a hooper among them?
Reggie, my son plays basketball and baseball. He goes to the Episcopal Academy and his basketball coach is Taylor Wright, Jay Wright's son.
Okay.
And Taylor's the assistant baseball coach. So he plays both and he plays defense, but he's a shooter. It's something I couldn't do. He can do very well.
Okay.
And then my daughter, she's going to be a rising senior at the Hill School, and she's committed to play goalie at Syracuse. She'll graduate in 2025. And then then I have a little one who's 8, Emery, and I coached her this year on her girls' team. She was second, third, and fourth grader, so I was one of the coaches for that. So she's my hooper.
Nice. Hey, it's been close to a decade. You're really doing well. Any itch to get back into the NBA? Any itch whatsoever?
I'd love to. I mean, I'd love to get back in because of the fact that it's about the people. I love the players. I love putting a team together and building that team and working. There's nothing like starting at the beginning of the season with a team and then tinker it to try to get there and see the success when he wins. You can't replace the highs and the lows that you go through running a team, but I would love to. I would love the opportunity to help because I'm a much better, much wiser now than I was earlier in my career doing it. Probably a little more patient. But over the years, it's the experience I've had. I think I'm better suited to do an even better job now.
Billy King, I thank you so much for joining us on Fresh 24.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of Fresh 24. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Check out our friends over at Philadelphia Sports Nation, a local Philadelphia sports site covering your favorite teams across blogs and social media. PHLSportsNation.com. Philadelphia Sports Nation. PHL Sports Nation. Enhancing your Philadelphia sports fan experience.